You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 2nd of April 2024 on Monocle Radio.
Israel attempts to silence at least one avenue of critical coverage, China makes Indonesia's trains run on time, and why senior Swiss politicians will have to start paying for their own days on the slopes. I'm Andrew Muller, the Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Nina Dos Santos and Jonathan Fenby will discuss today's big stories, and we'll hear from Slovakia, where voters may be preparing to elect a president largely on the grounds that he doesn't get on with the Prime Minister. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Nina Dos Santos, international broadcast correspondent and formerly CNN's Europe editor, and by Jonathan Fenby, author and former editor of the South China Morning Post. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
Excitingly, for our light introductory banter segment, this will make it easy. I don't have to do the agonising gear-grinding link from one to the other because you've both just been to France. Nina, would you like to go first?
Oh, yes, absolutely, because I went to the part of France that's a bit closer to us here in London, the Normandy coast, Deauville, in the sunshine and lovely Honfleur. I've filled up on oysters for the rest of the year and I'm feeling pretty smug.
Right. So you recommend the Normandy coast, basically. Obviously, it will be massively in the news in June, circa the 80th anniversary of D-Day. Were you there trying to avoid the rush?
I just love the place at Easter. And, you know, the weather's sometimes a little bit inclement, but I've got to say I was quite lucky. You know, even went on the ferry, not the Eurotunnel this time, which, you know, coming across the channel just yesterday evening was glorious in the sunshine. So I'm feeling quite blessed, actually.
See, I have...
Having been in France.
On the occasions I have done that trip by ferry, I have so far been very lucky in that I've never had one of the crossings that people talk about for years afterwards. So it was quite smooth this time.
I did go out in the middle of the storm just before Good Friday. So that was a bit tricky. But, you know, at the end of the day, it was just lovely being back in France. And I've got to say, you know, covering things like the upcoming European parliamentary elections that are coming up in the next few months, you get the feeling really leaving the UK and heading over towards France. And I've said it before on this show that, you know, the UK really is drifting into a different political orbit, as, of course, all of these different places are going to the polls later on. And we realise just how long ago Brexit actually was.
And it feels weirdly like even longer. Jonathan, you have also been to France. In telling us where and why, I will allow you to plug an upper limit of two of the books you have written on the subject of that country.
Well, History of France and the biography of Charles de Gaulle. And Charles de Gaulle, as far as I know, never went to the area we visited.
Now that's a segue.
That's a segue.
Do they have a plaque? Charles de Gaulle never stayed here.
Did not sleep here, indeed. No, we were in the southern Périgord, below the River Dordogne, which used to be, we used to keep well clear of it because it was full of English people, basically, and that was pre-Brexit. And whether it's a coincidence or not, but post-Brexit, a lot of the English people appear to have sold up and gone away. And our son, who, as it happens, lives in Singapore, has bought a house in a tiny hamlet in the southern Périgord. It is so tiny, this hamlet, that it doesn't have a cafe, it doesn't have any shops, but being French...
You're not really selling it.
It has a church and a mayor's office opposite one another.
Okay, the mayor does not have a great deal to do, though, I'm guessing.
Oh, the mayor, I asked him a pointed question about when a projected cafe would open up. He said, when the work is finished.
Good answer.
I bet you one thing, though, having been to the French Lycée Charles de Gaulle here in London, they probably got a school named after him there, even if he didn't visit it.
Well, the school's closed down because... But there's a school in the next door town, which is only 4 kilometres away. But one of the classes is being stopped at that school. And it's full of placards saying, bring back back our class.
Oh, that's sad, isn't it, villages?
Even when there's literally nobody there, they can find a way to protest.
Oh, there are protests all over the place.
Absolutely heartening.
The farmers have been on the rampage recently, and their rampage style is turning the indicator boards for the names of villages and towns upside down.
Bless them. We will be starting the show proper in Israel, where the Knesset has approved a measure which would give Israel's government the power to temporarily suspend broadcasts by television channels it believes unconducive to Israel's national security. As confirmed by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the likely first target of this stricture is the Qatar-based station Al Jazeera, of whose reporting Israel has long been unfond, to the extent of bombing the building which housed Al Jazeera's Gaza Bureau in 2021. Several Al Jazeera employees have also been among the dozens of Palestinian journalists killed during the current Gaza war. Jonathan, first of all, why is Israel doing this? I mean, they know surely it's not actually going to stop anybody outside Israel watching Al Jazeera. It's not going to stop anybody in Israel who really wants to watch Al Jazeera watching Al Jazeera either.
No, I think it's a political gesture. Netanyahu insists that there is a link between Al Jazeera and Hamas without having produced any evidence, as far as I've seen, for that. A lot of the film coming out of Gaza, because international journalists can't go into Gaza at the moment, presumably comes through Al Jazeera.
It does. It comes from Al Jazeera's freelancers, and I think they have some staff on the ground in Gaza who are obviously doing quite a job in, frankly, unimaginable circumstances. Yeah. Nina, does this make any actual sense from Netanyahu's point of view, or is this just him throwing a bone to his angry right-wing hyper-conservative base? He can say, look, I'm doing this. It doesn't mean anything, but I'm doing it.
Well, I think Jonathan's right here that what he's probably trying to do is exert a pressure on Qatar, isn't he, in terms of sort of hostage negotiations and so on and so forth. And as Jonathan was pointing out, you know, the eyes of the world are trying to fixated on Gaza and trying to get a scale of the human suffering there. Mm. The Gaza-based health ministry says that over 37... What was the death toll, the latest death toll, Andrew? I think it was 37,000 people,
it's
at least.
It's well north of 30,000 at this point.
Exactly. So according to the latest figures, and those are the figures that are coming out of, you know, the Hamas-run Gaza health ministry over there, it's very difficult for independent journalists to get any sense of the scale of the suffering there. And we're on the cusp of a human-made famine here now. And just yesterday, several aid workers with the World Food Kitchen were sent in, and they obviously were killed, including British nationals, a Polish national, and others. So there's real concern here that Gaza is on the cusp of a real, even bigger humanitarian disaster. And the question is whether or not Benjamin Netanyahu wants the world to be able to see that. Obviously, the Committee for the Protection of Journalists has said that they're extremely concerned by this new legislation. Because, by the way, it doesn't just encompass the likes of Al Jazeera, which obviously is linked to Qatar. It could potentially ban the work of other foreign journalists who are there as well. So even if, for instance, international networks manage to smuggle themselves in to get a sense of the suffering, they then could find themselves on the wrong side of the law here as well.
Jonathan, what in general have you made of Israel's media management of this conflict? As Nina was saying, it is next to impossible for anybody to get into Gaza from outside. There have been some brief embeds with the IDF. There's been one or two overflights by film crews in those planes rather haphazardly scattering aid over the Gaza Strip. But in terms of actual independent reporting from outside agencies, there's been next to nothing.
No, and it should be pointed out, of course, in terms of balance, which I'm sure you're very keen on, that Hamas isn't exactly journalist-friendly either.
They are not.
They are not, indeed. But I think Israel, from the beginning, and I would guess that it was part of the Hamas game plan from October the 7th onwards, that Israel comes out badly in its media management and from its pursuit of the war and its explanations as to what it's doing.
Nina, as a general principle, though, is there ever a case for banning a news outlet? I mean, obviously, Israel is not alone in doing this. The EU and the UK, for example, have both punted RT, the Russian propaganda outlet, off their airwaves.
And Chinese networks.
Chinese networks. Also, I think the Iranian network Press TV, the Hezbollah-run Al-Manar have all been censured / censored in various jurisdictions. How do you make that decision? I mean, it strikes me that, and I want to be as clear as I can be about this, there is obviously a colossal difference between something like RT and Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera actually is a proper news outlet. It does have institutional biases, but then who doesn't? Whereas RT, Press TV, etc., are fairly straightforward propaganda outlets.
Well, the UK obviously has legal frameworks already in place with, for instance, Ofcom, that is the regulator that regulates the broadcast and digital space. So there are already regulations in place here, and when, of course, people like RT, Chinese TV networks, Iranian TV networks spout propaganda and so on and so forth, it breaches those rules. So the UK has a legal framework by which it can remove the licence to actually broadcast. But what we're talking about here with Netanyahu, as far as I can see, is afterwards introducing legislation at a time of war here that immediately curtails networks like Al Jazeera's ability to report. They're knowing full well that this is probably the only source of information that's going to be making its way out through journalists. Yes, it's true. You know, some people in Gaza, if they can get access to, you know, electricity, they can take videos with their mobile phones. We're seeing a lot more material coming from places like Gaza and Ukraine that are non-journalists.
And obviously it doesn't stop Al Jazeera broadcasting to literally the entire world outside Israel.
No, yeah, for sure.
And then I think on top of that, there's the worrying thing that Nina referred to, which is that the legislation, as far as one has seen it, could be extended to just about anyone there. And so you get into the kind of syndrome which you got in China and certainly in Hong Kong now, with national security being waved about by a government as a reason for what is basically press censorship.
Just finally on this, Jonathan, I do want to draw upon your wealth of experience here, because Vietnam is often advanced as the reason that the militaries of the Western world especially stopped being quite so open and helpful to the press, because correspondents covering the Vietnam War were famously, like yourself, but the Americans were awarded the equivalent rank of captain and basically allowed to go wherever they liked.
We were indeed, thinking back to Vietnam, and we reported a lot of things that the Americans and the South Vietnamese didn't like at all. But there was a kind of joshing almost, oh, you guys, you know, the military would say, oh, you guys, you've got to earn a living, so you reported that we torched that village or whatever it might be. But it was a different world then.
Well, let's take a look now at China, which is not the first empire of one sort or another to have furthered its reach and influence by rail. Indonesia has recently noted the 2 millionth passenger journey on the evocatively named and China-financed Whoosh, the high-speed train which whisks passengers the 140 kilometres between Bandung and Jakarta in under an hour, which is quicker than many current services from London Euston to Watford Junction. For the benefit of listeners outside London, you could just about walk that if you had to, and a big shout-out to any exasperated listeners currently doing exactly that. Anyway, China's President Xi Jinping, hosting Indonesia's President-elect Prabowo Subianto in Beijing, has described Whoosh as a gold standard of cooperation. Nina, would it be really an entirely bad idea for the UK just to completely abandon its rail network to China?
Well, they've kind of abandoned it to the private sector, haven't they? So very few of us can afford to use it. You could write a whole thesis on that, couldn't you? But I think this is an interesting one, isn't it? Because it sort of, correct me if I'm wrong, Jonathan, but this sort of signals the revival of these big Chinese infrastructure projects backed by big amounts of Chinese money. I was sitting in an event in the House of Commons, I think, this time last year with a few US diplomats who were over again to talk about how now that the pandemic is over, yes, China's economy is a bit shakier than it was before, but they're probably going to start investing a lot in this, you know, infrastructure development, providing the finance for it. And this is obviously an opportunity for Xi Jinping to show everybody that, by the way, in a very dangerous seismic part of the world where it's difficult to do these types of projects, 2 million people are benefiting from being able to use these, you know, these big infrastructure projects. Is it a revival of the Belt and Road Initiative? I mean, I don't know, in some way, maybe?
It is. The Belt and Road Initiative, which Xi Jinping launched 10 years ago or so, was a grab-all, catch-all kind of programme. I remember being in China at the time, and local entrepreneurs often said, oh, well, I've got some excess capacity, my factory isn't working too well, I'm going to export bits of it, bits of the factory, to, that was Central Asia, particularly at that time, and the state will cover it, and nobody will dare to question my bank loan because Xi Jinping has given it his stamp of approval. So you've got this huge outflow of Chinese projects. And then about 5 years ago or so, Beijing seemed to realise that all this was running completely out of control, and they brought it much, much more under control. And they want to produce big projects like the one in Indonesia and wow the world and win the favour of countries away from the United States.
But on that thought, Jonathan, it has often been noted that China's financial assistance and its engineering expertise does tend to come with a certain number of strings attached. Is a country the size of Indonesia at a relative advantage, though, compared to, say, for example, a lot of smaller countries in Africa? Because Indonesia can't be readily shoved around.
No, Indonesia is important, but because of its size, because of its population, because of its geographical position, and China has been trying to expand very much into the greater Pacific area, and also because Indonesia has got a lot of things which the Chinese want, like nickel. Chinese electric car company BYD is going to set up a plant in Indonesia using Indonesian nickel, and that will be a great win for China, I think.
Nina, do you get the sense that European countries in particular are getting a bit more nervous about China than they once were? Because the Belt and Road idea was certainly supposed to reach Europe, but I guess what I'm wondering is, following the realisation in the last couple of years that enveloping Russia in theoretically a mutually beneficial economic relationship has not worked out tremendously well because Russia is at heart Russia, are people now starting to wonder if they may have made the same miscalculation about China?
Well, we're certainly seeing a bit of a U-turn in places like Italy, aren't we? Where you remember, they had a big push under Matteo Salvini's time, didn't they, a few years ago, to have joint policing operations. You know, they definitely wanted to be part of the Belt and Road Initiative, and now Giorgia Meloni has gone and put a real damp, wet cloth on that and stopped it in its tracks. Places like Serbia, though, as well, still a little bit more.
And Greece. I mean, also, China has established itself very strongly in the Piraeus, and seeing Greece as the door to Europe.
Yeah, for sure, because of the debt crisis, and they can buy their way in then. But actually, just the other day, Hungary, last month, announced a new sort of joint policing and security cooperation agreement with China as well. Obviously, Viktor Orban is a bit of the bête noire of Europe, so he likes going against the grain. But it does go to show that there's obviously, particularly in parts of Europe where, you know, there's a lot of support for these fringe populist prime ministers who, you know, have slightly autocratic tendencies, definitely still potentially able to get into bed with China and, you know, available to do joint, you know, give them a footprint over here. Not as big as before, though.
I am glad you mentioned autocratic prime ministers with authoritarian tendencies, Nina, because following the first round of Slovakia's presidential elections on March 24th, Ivan Korčok, a former Slovak ambassador to the US and Germany, has a comfortable lead over his rival Peter Pellegrini, who is an ally of the controversial four-time and current incumbent Prime Minister Robert Fico. Korčok is a harsh critic of Fico's policy, and his popularity has been helped by a wave of anti-government protests that shook Slovakia in recent months. Monocle's Alexei Korolev asks whether Korčok could emerge victorious in the runoff for the largely ceremonial Slovak presidency this Saturday.
Pre mňa je takým prezidentom Ivan Korčok. Prosím, privítajte ho na javisku.
Ivan Korčok has been drawing crowds across Slovakia. A pro-Western ex-diplomat and government minister, He's now hoping to become the country's next president.
Dobrý večer, milé Žilinčanky, Žilinčania.
He has good grounds for confidence. In the first round of voting, he unexpectedly came out on top, well ahead of Peter Pellegrini, a government loyalist and parliament speaker who had been widely seen as the front runner. Both men are steeped in Slovak national politics. They have even been cabinet colleagues in the past. But today they represent two radically different visions for their country.
One part of Slovakia is deeply Western, and I don't mean Western geographically, but Western culturally. And the other part of the country is showing a lot of sympathies toward the East and is really living on the edge of Europe in this sense. And these two worlds have very few in common and are clashing for the last 30 years.
Michal Vašička is a well-known Slovak sociologist. In his office in the capital Bratislava, he says this presidential campaign is not just about the issues of the day, the war in Ukraine, the rising cost of living, or the rights of minorities. It goes right to the heart of Slovak national identity.
Slovakia has practically no consensus about national history, national figures, national events that are important for the country in positive or negative terms. And since the beginning, Slovakia was deeply polarized. And you would say, well, every country is deeply polarized these days. But in Slovakia, it's almost a civilization clash. And what is happening now is just the result of even deeper polarization, which came with, first of all, postmodern world, if you want, late modernity, and results of existence of social media, which turned Slovakia apart, I must say.
Although Ivan Korčok's first-round success defied expectations, it follows a pattern seen in previous Slovak presidential elections.
Voľby prezidenta 2024. Volí celé Slovensko.
The last two also went to a second round. Both then produced a pro-Western president, Andrej Kiska in 2014 and Zuzana Čaputová in 2019. Then, as now, the government was run by Prime Minister Robert Fico, a right-wing populist explicitly opposed to European liberal values. So why do Slovaks seem to favour liberal presidents while at the same time choosing illiberal governments? Fedor Blaščák is the director of the Open Society Foundation in Bratislava.
The role of president is not yet fixed. Slovakia is a very young democracy. It's like a fragile flower. Needs watering, needs care, needs cultivation. So these figures, these political figures who stepped into a presidential office, we had five presidents so far, they are now historically in position to form the role of president in Slovak political system. And when you look at those five former presidents, you can see that it's a very heterogeneous group. So now we are coming to the point that we have like very similar candidates, both active politicians, one professional diplomat, one professional politician, leader of the party, 20, 30 years of political experience. So this result of coming elections will tell us much more about whether there is a majority of Slovak society which opposes Fico's politics.
So it'll be like a referendum on Fico.
Yeah, that's peculiar situation because Korčok and Pellegrini were sitting in one government for some time. They're colleagues from the previous Fico's government. Korčok was a state secretary at the time on the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Mm. Pellegrini was a minister. In the past, we can see that they were part of one political current, and now each of them became a symbol, a key representant of opposing political currents. But again, the function and the role of campaign, its quality, its strategy, will decide.
With both candidates now working hard to rally supporters, the contest can go either way. But there is a sense that after months of anti-government protests, many Slovaks will want to see a counterbalance to Robert Fico in the presidential office. For Monocle, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Thank you, Alexei. And listening to that were Nina Dos Santos and Jonathan Fenby. Nina, It does still seem weird, doesn't it, that there are portions of Eastern Europe right now, given, you know, everything, where there is still an amount of political sentimental fondness for Russia at large.
That's right. And as I was saying before, we've got these EU parliamentary elections coming up. And I know I bleat on about this on this show, much to your irritation, Andrew, but it's the only really democratically elected one of those three key institutions. And it's also one that these countries like Slovakia have an outside voice on, and that fringe parties, particularly from the far right, get a big voice and they get a chance to have that voice heard. We're expecting about 25% of the seats to go to fringe and far right parties, and that doesn't necessarily include, you know, just Slovakia. We're talking about other countries as well. That means that people like Robert Fico is at the helm of a national government, also, you know, has his message amplified at the EU Parliament as well. And so what you're seeing here in Slovakia is really interesting, because traditionally, if I'm not wrong, as Alexei was just pointing out before there, the presidency is kind of a ceremonial role as a bulwark against authoritarianism. But now we're really seeing, as you were saying before, people split in the country because they feel that that role should be reinforced, because Fico is now back in office for a fourth time, and because people like Donald Trump, by the way, might get into the White House. And he's made all these sort of unpleasant comments about if people aren't paying their way in NATO, well, Russia should be allowed to ride roughshod all over NATO territory, and that'll start in places like the border with Poland and Slovakia.
Jonathan, has the EU and indeed NATO learnt anything from its recent experiences of dealing with members that have gone rogue, Hungary currently and Poland until recently?
I think it has drawn some kind of lesson from that, which is to be tougher with them. And you can see that to some extent in its dealings with the more populist, the more extreme, the more nationalist rulers in Eastern Europe. So we should see that continuing, I think.
Just a final quick thought on this, Nina. Is there, and I guess a follow-up to what I just asked Jonathan, is there a way of addressing this tendency, especially in those European publics, that doesn't further entrench the problem? There's only really so many ways I can think of that you can point out that, you know, Russia has demonstrated, not just in the last 2 years, but the last 10 years, and indeed in the preceding decades, that it does not necessarily have the best interests of Eastern Europe at heart.
Well, but then in places like Slovakia, you've got large amounts of migrants coming from Ukraine, don't you? And that again further fractures society and, you know, emboldens populists like Robert Fico. I think the EU is in a really difficult position. It's akin to the type of position it was in vis-a-vis Viktor Orban of Hungary when the UK Brexited. You remember, you had all these sort of, you had Orban obviously at the helm of his national government, but people like Marine Le Pen from the far right in France, you know, agitating to challenge the EU to say, well, OK, if you're not happy with the rules, go on, Hungary, you go. And then you'll have other Visegrad 4 countries leaving as well. So I think they're in a really difficult position here. They can't push too far, but they have to send enough of a signal. I think they did it in a very interesting way, didn't they, with regards to aid over Ukraine for Hungary, where obviously Viktor Orban got completely checkmated and left out of the room when they all voted to get round those unanimous voting rules. You might see more of that, I don't know.
Well, finally, on today's show, this is why I've been saying we need a gong in the studio. In the usually fervid field of politics, occupying high office in Switzerland must be, compared to most, a pretty sweet gig. It pays remarkably well. A federal councillor, i.e. a member of Switzerland's inner cabinet, trousers the equivalent of nearly €500,000 annually, excluding expenses and the fat pension looming after leaving office. Added to which, how hard can it be? The country you're governing is proverbial for its wealth and the degree to which stuff in general already works. However, one perk is to be forfeited. In a supernaturally Swiss gesture of hair-shirted solidarity, the federal councillors are turning in their free ski passes. Jonathan, first of all, the free ski passes are worth another €4,500 each annually. I mean, even if several of these are returned, this is not going to make a huge difference to the budget.
It isn't, and you've talked in euros, but of course they're paid in Swiss francs. ranks, indeed, I imagine, which gets stronger and stronger and worth more and more.
I mean, 4,350 euros worth of Swiss francs, Nina, that will nearly buy you lunch at some bakeries in Zurich.
Look, no comment here. I know your editorial director, Tyler Brulé, who might be listening to this, lives in fine Switzerland. I couldn't afford to go skiing in Switzerland this year or into Italy.
I couldn't afford to go to a bakery in Switzerland. That's my point.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it seems about time, doesn't it? If I'm a member of the Swiss electorate, you know, this is one heck of a perk.
Well, it is a heck of a perk, but it's a response, apparently, Jonathan, to a recent referendum on March 3rd, which did favour more social welfare.
So we had a referendum on ski passes.
Well, no, they didn't actually have the referendum on ski passes, which would be an even more Swiss thing to do, but they need to find apparently another 5 billion euros or the Swiss franc equivalent from somewhere, so this is where they're making a start.
Yeah, well, all I can say is they can probably afford to buy their own passes.
Oh, I think they could. But I do wonder, though, Nina, and I realise Switzerland is a bit of a law unto itself and not everything that works in one country is exportable to another. But I would be happy to make the trade they have made, i.e. where we pay our politicians absolute skipfuls of money, everything basically works, and we never hear from them. An experiment to try and prove my point, last time I was in Switzerland, which was a few years ago now, but everybody I interacted with on that trip, taxi drivers, hotel staff, restaurant staff, everybody I was interviewing, I just asked them, can you name your current president or what the effective role is? Slightly more than half had absolutely no idea who was in charge.
That's right. They are quite low-key figures, aren't they? The Swiss presidents. It always catches me out. I met one in Romania last month.
I mean, a gathering
of the centre-right parties.
So I might have,
I do know it's a lady whose name I think is Viola.
Well, they keep their heads down normally, and probably because they're so busy skiing.
Well, apparently so. But we did want to close this discussion out by asking you both, and I'll ask you first, Jonathan, have you ever had a job which did come with fabulous perks attached to it? And we're failing that. I mean, I know they're thin on the ground in journalism generally. Or have you ever run across one in somebody perhaps you encountered that you were fearfully jealous of?
I was in the wrong trade.
Vietnam, I'm not
You took
surprised.
The job. Yeah, you had perks. When you came back from an operation, you might have somebody would offer you a vodka. Or a vodka and tonic, if you were really lucky. I've never had great perks. Other people have taken, who I know, have, as it were, taken advantage of their positions and done quite well out of it. I'll stop it there.
Nina?
Gosh, that was a segue. I have not taken advantage of my position and done well out of it yet. But I did start out my...
But you're open to doing so.
And no way. I did start out my career in Milan, where for a short period of time when I was much younger, I got the chance to hobnob with the likes of Armani and Dolce & Gabbana and go to the fashion shows. And our newsroom used to get sent lots of freebies from all the big designers. What we used to do is we used to auction it among ourselves and then give the money to charity because we just didn't want to accept something straight out, but the stuff was so lovely that you did want to wear it. So, you know, that was one way around it. I want to ask one question, though, Andrew. When it comes to these skiing politicians, you know, if skiing is so important for the Swiss, don't tell me, I'm assuming they don't subsidise watches as well, right? Because that's the other part of the Swiss economy.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure where they are on subsidies for cuckoo clocks, triangular chocolate or cheese with holes in it either. Finally, I will say the one perk of office I have been most jealous of, partly because the advantage of it was starkly illustrated to me trying to fly back from the NATO summit in Vilnius last summer, as me and Team Foreign Desk sat there as our Ryanair flight was delayed interminably, while Joe Biden was just driven straight to the bottom of his plane, walked up the stairs, and it took off. And I just, that's the way to travel.
But we now know the reporters were nicking stuff from the plane, right? According to the press, where the White House has said, you've got to hand it all back, press corps.
You're expecting Air Force One to be waiting for you.
Or the equivalent. I mean, a medium-sized Gulfstream would do. I'm a reasonable man.
Yeah.
If I ever got a ride on Air Force One, by the way, I would totally nick something.
Well, count yourself lucky with Ryanair.
Well, there wasn't anything to pinch. Jonathan Fenby and Nina Dos Santos, thank you for joining us. That is all for this edition of The Daily. Thanks to our panellists today and to Alexei Korolev in Vienna. Today's show was produced by Chris Chermak and researched by George Ruskin. Our sound engineer was Tamsin Howard. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.